So again, good morning, everyone. It's nice to see you. Most of you see you. I'm seeing you in little squares in the back of the room on the projected screen. It's nice to see some of you, probably have a dozen people live. And I think we all look forward to the day when we can be back together. In person, as much as possible. So this morning I want to continue our discussion that we began last week. And again, the talk from last week is published on our YouTube channel. So it is there, so I won't go into a lot of what happened last week. But it was very interesting. The topic was, I believe, drugs, sex, rock and roll, and the Dharma. And person on AV who handles all the questions at the end when we took questions said there had never been as many questions as last week. So that made me think then we should continue because I couldn't get to everybody. I believe this is again a topic, as I said last week, that is very germane. To us, especially at this first month of the year, when many of us are looking at our actions, our behaviors, and thinking about, as is traditional, after the new year, after the beginning of new, do I want to chart, a different course in my life? Looking at our behaviors, I think, is one way to do it. But it's very important that we understand when we look at things like drug, sex, rock and roll, which is a euphemism for all pleasure-seeking behaviors, as I said last week, but also specifically, the essential role of sexuality and intoxicants around the fundamentals of what Buddhist ethics is about, which is doing no harm, you see. And so areas where we could do the most harm are sort of focused on primarily in Buddhist ethics. But again, to undertake any kind of ethics in Buddhism, it's called right action, moral conduct, has to be in a context, you see. We can't go situation by situation, personal life to personal life, because the actions that we take have effects. The thoughts that we have effects. The words that we speak have effects. So it has a lot to do with my own the context of my own personal life, where I'm going in my life, where I want to go in my life. And it has to do also with the societal context. How is the way my life unfolds in the broader realm of the life of my family, my culture, my society? So it is in this broader context that we need to look at the specifics. If people don't kind of see the context or don't share a context, then something that could be wholesome and unwholesome for one person or right or wrong for one person, maybe not for another. So this is, this is important that we understand. The fundamentals of Buddhist ethics was, again, that people are on a path of transformation. People want to change. And the fundamental thing about a human being is it is through the actions of our body, speech, and mind that we unfold and that we experience life and interact in life. And so if we're not attentive to the actions of our body, speech, and mind and their effects, both on the mind stream or on others, then the desire to move our life or transform our life will not occur. There has to be this attention to the actions of our body, speech, and mind. No matter how good a heart you have, no matter how so-called enlightened you are. You know, there was a great Buddhist teacher who expressed, he said, outwardly, I practice right action impeccably, meaning the actions of my body, speech, and mind, impeccably. He said, inwardly, I practice the great heart of love and compassion. Secretly, I practice the teachings of non-duality, emptiness. Very interesting. You know, some people turn it around. But, you know, we are known by our actions. And we interact with the world through our actions, through our speech, but that is all driven by our mind. So I want to hear from you, but I also heard from a number of people this week, members who wrote to me about my talk last week. So it generated a lot of discussion, which is good. And many people were very happy that this thing is now being talked about openly. I mean, it's always been talked about, but I guess it's never been focused on so dearly. Even though we have had lots of talks on the trainings and the precepts, so I'm not sure what this is about. But anyhow, I'm willing to respond. But first, there was somebody who wrote me, sort of giving me a little pushback for what I shared this week. They were concerned that, because I think last week I shared a bit in terms of my own practice, you know, how I do in my home, how I deal with family and relations who do drink or do eat meat or things like that. And I was just sharing my example of my life. Well, somebody felt concerned about that, that this could be the teacher sharing that they don't drink or only eat vegan food or serve vegan food in their home could send the message that this is the skillful or right way to one's life. Yet there are many Buddhists who may obtain some level of enlightenment who eat eggs, milk, or a glass of wine from time to time. So this person is confusing what I just talked about. Whatever enlightenment means, and I don't know what this person means, we're talking about actions of body, speech, and mind. Not about the understanding of the empty nature, which again, traditionally, a true enlightenment also is a true experience of caring to end and wanting to end the suffering of other people, and therefore not doing anything that would create the suffering. But I think, a teacher is a teacher. And, you know, I'm teaching Buddhist ethics. I'm teaching what my teachers taught me. I'm teaching what we transmit in the five mindfulness trainings. I'm not making anything up, you see. But one of the roles of a teacher is to take the teachings and to give examples and show people how to apply them in their life. Okay? So that's what a teacher does. Now, what the student does with that teaching is up to them, right? And I think what I'm trying to ask people to do is look at openly and clearly these actions around, in this case, the things that we can, well, I called them pleasure-seeking activities, which is a more traditional way of Buddhism to look at things. In Buddhist psychology, there are positive, pleasant, positive, unpleasant, negative, and neutral experiences. Every moment, every sense experience is either positive, negative, or neutral, pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. And it's very natural for human beings to go toward what? The pleasant, the pleasurable. That's just very natural. To not want to go to that which is unpleasurable, right? And, you know, neutral is somewhere in the middle. The problem in the human realm, again, is that we are a realm of desire. We are always wanting and needing. That is a fundamental to the unenlightened mind. And to understand that there is a fundamental, because we do not know our true nature, because we are not able to rest in a wholesome way in the present moment, because we don't know the innate perfection of this moment, we are always, we want to be happy. We want to be at peace. So we move toward objects that give us short-term pleasure, a moment of happiness, a moment of peace, a moment of no longer grasping because we have what we wanted. Unfortunately, with those experiences I've said last week, they don't last. And not only do they not last, the more we do them, the less pleasure we get out of them, so we have to do them more and more. There's an innate paradox. It's as they say in Buddhism, it's like a thirsty person drinking salt water. You can drink lots and lots and lots of salt water and momentarily quench your thirst, but it'll only make you thirstier. That is the analogy. And so I think it's important to, you know, for us to look at that. So to share Buddhist precepts, or for the Buddha, for the teacher to give, as all teachers do, examples of how to live a life, I think that is not based on trying to tell people what to do. Everybody's got to decide what they got to do. You know, I mean, we don't go into people's homes and tell people what to do. But we have to teach, you know, we have to teach the way. And in this world where, as we know, if we watch the news, there is so much confusion about the right way. You know, how does one do actions that support the transformation of the world in a wholesome way? That supports the creation of a world where people do not harm each other, where people take care of each other, where people don't cause suffering to each other. People, in other words, do their best to facilitate happiness and well-being, you know. Well, we get there through our own actions of body, speech, and mind, as well as obviously societal ways. So it behooves a teacher. I mean, you know, again, the person goes on to say, members may become, you know, what message do we want to send? Members could become wary of whom to have over dinner, since someone may spot a bottle of wine, a carton of eggs, or fish in the fridge. You know, I don't know. If that's what you have in your home and you're comfortable in your home and you invite people over. I mean, I go to people's homes, especially my family and relatives' homes. I mean, they don't go out of their way to hide their eggs. Or to hide their wine bottles. I mean, I don't know. And I don't go out of my way to, I don't go around their homes pointing things out to them. I mean, these are extremes. You know, laissez-faire is extreme and highly judgmental is extreme. We're the middle way. But, you know, I have no problem saying yes and no to what I want to say yes and no to without in any way offending people. I mean, I lived with the Tibetans and India and Nepal for a year and a half. Great meat eaters. I didn't eat meat. I never once was that ever problematic for any of them. Actually, they would always say to me, oh, you're a good Buddhist. We can't do that. And they would have cultural reasons or other reasons. I mean, it was very... you know, that's the way it should be. It's interesting now that most Buddhist monasteries are vegetarian or vegan. I mean, things have changed. And many of the teachers now, especially the younger Tibetans now, support a change that their elders didn't. So they said, do we want to be like churches? You know, but again, I'm not talking you know, that right or wrong, and this is not imposed. This comes out of, you know, I was reading something, and I think she was sort of I thought it was interesting. This was a woman, she was a Buddhist practitioner. She was sharing, you know, that she grew up in a culture to have a glass or two of wine was normal for dinner, and she always did that. But then when she learned about the Buddhist precepts, she began to watch that, and she stopped doing it. Right? And she was fine. But then she thought, oh, well, but I mean, every now and then she would have it with company or whatever. But then she said, ah, what's wrong with it, right? What's wrong with it? You know, it's benign. I'm not an alcoholic. I mean, I enjoy a glass of wine with dinner, so I'll start having a glass of wine at dinner. And she writes that was fine, but she also practices mindfulness and awareness. And she noticed, over as the weeks went on, earlier in the day or when it got close to dinner time, she would begin to look forward to her glass of wine. She would begin to make sure that there was always wine when she went shopping in the house. So she, and again, it wasn't like it was bad, but she just observed her mind. And she saw that something that seemed to start very benign over time began to ramp up, and one glass became two glasses. And it wasn't like it was a problem. And yet she said, if she was honest, and she's trying to be very honest, she says, when I look back on my life, does drinking change me? Yes. Why drink? I feel a little what? Less inhibited, a little more relaxed. Sounds very positive. Of course, these are things you can get just from practice. But she said, I also noticed that oftentimes it's when I'd had a glass or two of wine that I might say or do something that afterwards I would regret, right? Because one of the reasons that intoxicants of all types feel good and give us instant feeling of good, because they affect the frontal cortex, that place where we have, right thinking, where we have ability to think clearly and logically. You know, it dulls the thinking mind. That's why people like it. The problem is what? When we dull the thinking mind, oftentimes the unthinking mind will come forward. You know, when I was a therapist, oftentimes I'd work with couples and, you know, they seem to be doing well, then they have a blowout fight. And all of a sudden I started asking them, had anybody been drinking? Bingo. Bingo. You know, it's like all of a sudden, you know, and when you look in our society with so much domestic abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, teenagers, date rape, all these things we read about that cause such suffering in our society for people with long-lasting damage, how often are drug and alcohol present? Either in both parties, or one of the parties, it's pervasive. I mean, the research shows that. We have to be aware of the societal ramifications of what we do. I think that's the important thing. And then they went on to say about younger people who hear that, you know, who maybe heard what Fred's talk was. And they said, they may feel more comfortable attending social gatherings with a beer in hand. They may not feel, quote, comfortable in their skin yet, and the beer can give them some comfort at that moment in time. Exactly. I mean, that is a truth. And many people begin a lifelong pattern of using drugs and alcohol to deal with ego issues. Social anxiety is a self issue. It is a self that doesn't feel confident in itself, doesn't feel confident around people, has all kinds of ways of, you know, concerned about other people perceiving them, all kinds of things. And you're absolutely right. having a drink or two anesthetizes for a moment that part of their mind. And so they feel more comfortable. And if that was the only way, then I'd say fine. You know, it is, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh really expresses the need for the five mindfulness trainings because he very much cares about young people. And we know the pervasiveness of drug and alcohol use, of sexuality and sexual expression that does not have a lot of parameters is a major cause of suffering among young people. And again, you know, somebody who has social anxiety, you know, that can be dealt with. We should help young people who have social anxiety, right, who need a substance to feel comfortable in their own skin. And hopefully, if we're in those situations, they're our own children, our grandchildren, friends, you know, we want to help them find another way. So anyhow, I want to say that. Somebody asked me a question about how does polyamory fit into the mindfulness trainings or precepts? What is considered sexual misconduct? Again, in Buddhism, sexual misconduct, again, has to do with doing harm. It's not about lifestyle. It's not about who you do it with. It's how you do it and what you're doing it for that matters. I mean, it was interesting when I lived with the Tibetans, the community that I came into, my teacher and everything, were from Eastern Tibet. In Eastern Tibet, they practice polyandry. Not everyone. Polyandry meant, and again, it was more for economic reasons, but so if a woman married a brother, like the elder brother of a family, she got the other brothers. That's the way they kept, the way they kept sort of the wealth of the family or whatever, all, you know, it didn't get broken up. So all the brothers would have the same wife. Now, it didn't always work out that way. But anyhow, and so therefore, if you were a child of that, you were never sure which one of them were your father. You always called the elder one your father, but your uncle could also have been your father. It worked fine. I mean, you know, the Buddhist teachers didn't get upset about that. So, I mean, Buddhism talks about, you know, it doesn't talk about those kinds of things. But again, on the other hand, you know, to be able to pull off things like that, and I was quite amazed that they could pull it off growing up in American culture. I mean, if you could think about women kind of getting all the brothers, you know, if you establish a relationship, and yeah, and I guess I don't know what vice versa would be. Where you get all the other siblings. And anyhow, I mean, to me, it's a fairly advanced culture. We have enough problems just with one. But they do it quite well. I mean, there seemed to be no jealousy, no resentment. I mean, it was just very interesting. There seemed to be no harm. And so people, you know, when people talk about polyamory and all the other kind of amories that are about these days, it's like, can it really be done with no harm? No harm to the person? Can you really have sexual relations without attachment? Since sexuality and desire and et cetera are all about grasping and attachment. I mean, can you do it? I mean, you're a highly developed person if you can. Is there really no cost? See, these are the kind of questions we should be asking ourselves, and we should help young people to ask themselves. You know? So we don't want to impose our views or the Buddhist view, but we want to give parameters and get people to think. And again, we want to help people. So for some of us, that's still a very active condition in our life, but many of us are in touch with younger people, you know, of all kinds. I mean, some of our members are teachers and professors, right? Other people are parents or aunts and uncles. And, you know, we have lots of connections with younger people. And this is a major issue for them. Are we helping them? Somebody asked me a question about psychedelics and the path. It's funny, coming from the 60s, I thought that was ancient history. Shows you how I'm out of it. But when I was out a couple of years ago to the West Coast to spend some time at Roshi Hogan Bay's, the Chosen Bay's monastery, and meet their community, I found out that that's a real issue in lots of the Dharma world these days again. So. So somebody wrote me, I guess they have a friend who was into it and sent them some book to read and sent them some research that somebody had done some experiments with meditators at a meditation retreat. Some were given a psychedelic, others weren't. Again, they called that a double-blind study, but how the people taking the placebo wouldn't know they took a placebo was beyond me. So I'm not sure about the methodology there. But anyhow, showed positive effects. You know, that people had, you know, more mystical experiences, bliss, kind of non-self, out of themselves, other kinds of so-called mystical experiences, and also a reported positive effects afterwards. The Buddhist path is not about having experiences. The Buddhist path is about becoming a Buddha, an awakened one, someone who lives their life with understanding, wisdom, and compassion, and is dedicated to helping beings. It's about creating a person who lives a certain kind of life. It's not just about having experiences. Now, again, coming from the 60s, I would say, and at the early days at the Zen Center, I would say that most of us had some of those experiences. I mean, I went there in 68. And I think to be honest, for me, they were beneficial. I mean, they opened up my eyes to experiences that in my little 1950s world, people were not having or talking about. But it was a very different time. So I would say having those kinds of experiences was very opening. And I think, made many of us open to a spiritual path. I mean, we knew about religion, belief in religion, going to church or temple, but we didn't know about spiritual experiences or walking a spiritual path as a path of transformation. So I think it opened us to that. I mean, I thought these were different days. So, I mean, I think, you know, everybody's going to find their way. That's all I would say on that. I don't know. I'm not here to tell people what to do or not to do. Again, always, one has to be careful. Obviously, these studies you quoted, you know, they were very controlled, and they were dealing with meditators, and they were on retreat, and they were followed up, and they did all kinds of psychological and other kinds of tests to make sure, you know, there's no free lunch here when you talk about intoxicants and psychedelics. There are many people who've had experience extreme aversive or very negative. I mean, I've met people in the years who've sort of never come back from them. So, you know, there's no free lunch when one opens the mind, if the mind is not grounded or prepared. Interestingly, I have had a recent psychedelic experience. I just remembered. Personal sharing. A number of years ago, I had injured my back. Angie was not home. I was flat on my back. I'd been working outside with pulling on something and could not move. I tried to get on my doctor just to get some, to get my daughter to pick up some medication, some muscle relaxant, just so I could move. Couldn't get a hold of them. Remembered I had a friend who knew somebody, a good friend who was a pain doctor, whose office was not too far. So called her. She got me in touch with him, and he stopped by after work to help me out. Anyhow, I mean, it was a very bizarre experience. But one of the things that happened, he gave me, what did he give me? No, he gave me ketamine. Ketamine, which I later found out is, well, no, he gave me ketamine. I think he gave me a hypodermic of it. He used it in his product. And then he left. And I think for 2 hours, I mean, I was gone. I'll just say, I mean, I was gone. I really thought I was leaving my body. I was dying, and I was, but I have a very strong mind, and I have a lot of meditative experience. And so it was all good. I mean, I was okay with whatever happening. I think the only problematic thing is I didn't want to leave my body yet. I mean, I just felt this is crazy. I mean, I obviously wasn't dying. I don't know. But it sort of felt like that because I was on my way. So I say that. I eventually did come back into my body and did come back into life after a couple of hours. Am I right, Angie? But, and again, I think because I was because of my meditative experience, it was just another experience and I kind of knew what was happening. So I was never scared. I was always very aware of what was happening. I just kind of, you know, felt it was the wrong time. So there. I mean, again, I don't know what would it be like for other people. I think for most people, it would be very terrifying to have those kinds of experiences. But I leave it up to you. Well, there are lots of things. But let me open it up, okay? So please chat in any questions you have to Ray Lynn, who's in the back, and she will relay them to me. I think this is an important issue. You know, the Buddha said, in terms of his teachings on ethics, he used the word heedlessness. It's in the Pali, heedlessness. Not to be heedful. Heedful of what? Heedfulness of the effects of our actions, of body, speech, and mind. When we are not heedful, when we are not mindful, and oftentimes when we are in the throes of desire, in the throes of attraction, when we're in the throes of grasping at, wanting, needing, we often are not heedful of the effects of our actions on ourselves and others. And so the keeping of a clear mind, keeping the mind clear and aware and heedful is our protection. I mean, we just went through 4 years with a present administration that was not heedful of his words, of his actions. And we saw the damage that that does to someone who doesn't have a context in which they speak even, much less their actions. Now again, we see the danger when that occurs at the national level, but it begins at the personal level. Are we heedful of our own actions of body, speech, and mind? Are we heedful of the effects on our actions on others? Yes.
I just wanted to clarify. Someone asked if they could ask a question without their name being shared.
No, no.
Share names.
Oh, no, I don't share names. No. No, and the people who wrote me, I didn't share names, no. I mean, unless you want to, but no, I don't share names. So somebody else had written me, can one watch pornography ethically as a way to manage sexual energy? That was a nice one. I don't know. I mean, as I think I said last week, I'm aware that pornography is pervasive in our culture through the access of the internet. I understand that pornography is somewhat pervasive among adolescents these days, very accessible. You know, that feeds what? That feeds what? Sexual desire, I guess. Right? Isn't that what it's about? You know, again, you know, one has to ask oneself, why am I doing this? What is the purpose that I'm doing this? What's behind this? What's underneath this? This is the way, you know, we need to do it. Why are adolescents watching this all the time? For what reason? Is this managing their sexual energy, or is this moving it in all kinds of directions?
There's a question that's related to that.
Yes.
Let's see. Oh, now the questions are rolling in. There's one, I often have an impulse to relate to women first as sexual objects. I think it's demeaning and unfair, but is it totally unacceptable, or is it a part of normal sexuality?
Well, again, this is, we all begin in our ordinary, egocentric, deluded, worldly mind. Is that clear? That's where we are, all of us. You know, that's where we begin. And as human beings, or animals, we are programmed for sexuality because it has to do with the procreation, you know, the continuation of species. So therefore, there are pleasure centers, you know, in the body, as well as lots of visual cues that help create that. I mean, if you want to go into the field of sexuality, you can find out much more about it than listening to me. So that's a given. Right? Now, we live in a society where sexuality is continually being stimulated by the popular culture. And historically, the majority of that is treating women as what? Sexual objects. Right? I mean, that is the you know, that is just the nature of our society. So again, we grow up in a society where our desires, our natural desires, are constantly being manipulated. We have to understand that in everything, by people who want us to do something or buy something. Right? I mean, and that's just the nature of it. So yeah, we have to be careful. Again, you know, to have a desire that one sees is a desire and is aware of the kind of desire, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, whether it is facilitating right action or facilitating wrong action, whether it's facilitating right thought or wrong thought, whether it's moving me in the direction of how I want to relate to people that I'm sexually attracted to or not, whether it's becoming obsessive, you know. I mean, this only comes from self-awareness. And one has to be willing, if one is practicing deeply, to look at that. Don't be afraid. You decide, what is this really about? You know, in the latest thing of the trainings, they put in the sexual one, the loneliness of people cannot be solved through sexual relations. It's a warning. You know, many people are lonely. Loneliness is pervasive in our society. People feel alone, especially in this time of formal disconnection and quarantine. People feel alone. People feel lonely. So I would imagine, things like drinking or drugging or maybe pornography or all these things are on the upswing, because people don't want to have negative feelings. They want to have positive feelings. We understand that. The Buddha understand that. All the teachers understand that. That's why within the Buddhist teaching and practice, there are endless practices and teachings and reflections to help people create within themselves wholesome, positive mind states that feel good. You know, if it really was such a barren world, right, where happiness and connection were just unknown, then looking at a lot of these things that are less than perfect, might be okay. But the alternative is there. The problem is it takes some work. As I've said many times, doing things the way we've always done it is easy. We don't have to do anything. Is that clear? We don't have to do anything. We can stay the way we are, thinking the way we are, reacting the way we are forever, because we've made them all strong habits. It's all very natural. It's all very easy. Change takes some effort. It takes some self-awareness, right? It takes some willingness to enter new terrain. It takes some willingness to let go of actions of body, speech, and mind, behaviors that we're now looking at and going, this, even though I've been doing this for a long time, this may not be supportive of where I want to go in my life. Yeah, that's the problem. I understand. Yes.
Could you speak to more about other kinds of needs, both wholesome and unwholesome, besides physical pleasure, that may be involved in sexual encounters?
I mean, again, as we've said, people want to connect. People want to feel close to. You know, they talk about intimacy. You know, and often that is arranged. You know, intimacy means what? Close. We're intimate with something. We're intimate, I can be intimate with this flower because I'm close to it and I'm involved in it and I'm interested in it and I'm noticing it and I'm open to it. So I'm having an intimate relation now with this flower. It's very sweet. This is intimacy. But, I think because the sexual encounter is a physical encounter with that's pleasure oriented, the intimacy for a short time again happens. You know, people are naked. I mean, that's kind of intimate. You know, we don't get naked with too many people, do we? So, you know, taking off our clothes is intimate, isn't it? You know, being with somebody else in that way is very intimate. But I'm not sure that in people's minds they're really intimate. You know, because intimacy means I am present to you. Intimacy means there's no walls. If there is still manipulation, if there's still my needs, your needs, that's not real intimacy. If we're still up in our heads. You see, if we're having a fantasy, if we're not present. Intimate means I am here. And I can have an intimate relation with everything and anything. And obviously, you know, sexual intimacy can be a very intimate experience in a positive way for two human beings that care about each other, who want to express their love and caring for one another, to share an experience that they don't share with most people. But that need for connection, that need for intimacy, that need for a moment to feel loved. And we know in our society, many, especially young people, confuse love and sex. They want love, but they seek sex. Or they seek love and maybe they're given sex. That's the way they're, you know, that's the way they're allowed to get it, you see. It's sad, isn't it? Because that cannot meet their need. That's why they have to keep doing it again and again. Yes.
It's really hard for me to imagine that polyandry was working well for the women in Tibet. Did you know any women well during your time in Tibet and explore their view and experience of this practice?
Yeah, actually, my translator, and who we lived in their house and everything, was a woman who had two husbands. I mean, she married the elder, but she got the younger. It was very interesting, yeah, I mean, because I, you know, it was all very new to me. First of all, it was in their culture. And I think when things are in people's culture, they don't think about it. It's no different than... you know, there are many people, whether they have, and of course, they lived in a culture where families arrange marriages, which is another very interesting issue, because I go, wow, that's very different than how we do things. And she said, you know, her take on it was very, but she was a wonderful woman. Her take on it was, you know, we do it because our families want connections, and to marry a son and a daughter is one way to connect two families. I mean, it was that kind of deal. But she said, you know, so she was very open. She said, you know, so it's not about love, she said. It's about, you know, family and cultural kind of expectations. But she said, you know, if the person is a good person, over time, you grow to love them. I mean, we do it the opposite way. I mean, and I thought, well, you know, maybe they're more intelligent. See, we do it for what? For love. That's the first criteria. And yet we know love is a transient state. Passion is a transient state. Interest is a transient state. So we have the same problem, right? You know? How do you create a loving relationship? Well, it's only over time. And it takes a lot of working at it. Not working in a work sense, but a lot of conscious cultivation of that. And that's what she was saying. Could you get hooked up with a bad man and not a nice man? Yeah. But you know, there are lots of people, and maybe people who are listening to this call, who very consciously chosen their own partner in life and found out they weren't the nicest person. I mean, so I'm not sure whether it's really, at the end, significant difference. So, basically, if you ask me, from living with people who practice that and seeing lots of relations, but they didn't. You know, they didn't have the grasping. I mean, it was a very different kind of marriages. I mean, people were, they weren't open, but I mean, you know, they had big families, they had lots of aunts and uncles, and they had their people around them. They weren't, you know, they weren't looking for intimacy. They weren't looking for that kind of tight connection that we are with our little nuclear relations. In a certain sense, I was interested, and they were much freer, in a certain sense. Marriages in the Tibetan culture were not religious, they were societal. you sort of just got together in the house and invited everybody over and kind of announced that, you know, we're married or something. I'm not sure. I couldn't understand Tibetan. But that seemed to be what it is. And the whole community recognized that they were now, a married couple. But then I'd often find over time somebody was now with somebody else. I mean, these are like years later. I mean, people can kind of change, and it seemed to be perfectly fine. I mean, it wasn't, it was a very different culture, and children, I think, grew up with a sense they had many aunts and uncles, and, they weren't as, they weren't as focused on the dyad. Yeah, but I understand culturally it seems odd. I thought it was odd too, but it just seen in action, it seemed to be fine with them. I'm not sure with this modern Tibetan generation whether that's still practiced. Because again, it had financial, the whole reason for it, was financial or familial. Yes.
This is more of a comment, but I think it's a pretty good one. Last week's teaching seemed judgmental, but I had to step back and understand the teaching. The judgment was self-inflicted. The teaching was an example of Fred, not me. I then had to figure out how or if I want to mimic Fred. So today's teaching is easier to understand.
Well, no one's asking anybody to mimic Fred. I have enough trouble mimicking him. A teacher, teaching should not always be, facilitating our comfort. Teaching should be challenging. Teaching should make us think. Teaching should be provocative and make us really step back from our life. Many of the things that we do or think, that we take for normal and go, what is that about? What really is my intention here? Where is this coming from? I mean, we call this looking deeply. So the Buddhist teachings, in the ceremony it says, the Buddhist teachings are a mirror. The 5 mindfulness trainings, the 14 mindfulness trainings are a mirror in which we can look at ourselves, right? And so it's important that we look at ourselves, that we ask ourselves, why we're doing what we're doing. And is it true that this is really the better way or the wholesome way? I mean, don't be so rigid and resistance to have somebody challenge you. A good teacher would challenge us. Make us look more deeply at ourselves in life and how we interact. Again, but unless your teacher follows you into your home or, puts some kind of cam thing, some kind of, what do they call, those little spy things in your house, so they could monitor you. I would say that's going too far, okay? So I don't think we're there yet. And I certainly have no desire to monitor behavior. But I do have a desire to help people become aware, especially a community of people who seriously want and seek their own personal transformation equally to the transformation of the world. And therefore, we have this kind of double awareness. One is, how these actions of my body, speech, and mind affect me and the people I'm interacting with, but also, the action of, how they affect the whole world. I mean, when I met Thich Nhat Hanh in the 70s, he was already talking about becoming vegetarian because of, already he was talking about the harm of mass agriculture on our ecosystem. I mean, he was always talking about sustainability issues in terms of Buddhist ethics. It was interesting. I mean, so these things have lots of relevance. Our individual choices have lots of societal implications, right? A lot of the choices we make. We see, we go down the street to Publix and we just see things on the shelves. but we don't see how they got there. I remember Ty would use the example, there was some kind of special banana in Vietnam. He said, you know, you can't get it anymore in Vietnam. Because why? It's being exported. I remember when I went to, Guatemala, Costa Rica, one of those countries. You know, they're known for their coffee. You couldn't get a good cup of coffee. I mean, it was fascinating. I thought, wow, well, you know, those days I drank coffee. You know, it was like, you couldn't get a good cup of coffee. Mostly people drank Nescafe. I mean, it was, you know, this is a coffee exporting culture. Why? Because that's where, that's where the money was. So I'm just using that as examples. We need to, that our actions, even our individual actions of how we consume, have effects. Now, we don't have to become neurotic. I mean, some people get neurotic, you know, it's like, where does everything come from? You know, you would go crazy if you looked at everything you did and everything you wore, and everything you consumed, and, you know, it'd be like, you know, you wouldn't have any time to be happy in life. But some self-awareness is good. Yes.
You have referred to young people as having sex through pornography, but it is very pervasive with older people.
Mm-hmm.
It has destroyed two marriages that I know of. It is a real problem.
Yeah.
How do couples reestablish intimacy if one of the parties is going to pornography for intimacy?
Again, I mean, this is a general talk. So, I mean, I think those are very specifics. I'd be very happy to talk to that person if they're a member. Yeah, I mean, when I stopped my clinical practice about 15 years ago, the last couple of years, all of a sudden it was happening. I mean, I would have people come to me, either they were addicted to pornography or it would become a significant marital issue because one of them was using it. Yeah, so... Yeah, no, I guess I have a special feeling for young people. But yeah, I mean, addiction is possible for any age. Yeah, it is a problem. You know, I think it's a conscious problem. But, you know, what does intimacy mean? It means openness. It means trust. It means caring for. I mean, it's not, you know, you don't need to go to a course in it. You know, many of us, in the beginning of these relationships, when there was love, there was intimacy, right? You're very, you know, you think you found your partner in life. You're happy, you're open, you trust them, right? You see? So I think intimacy is not so difficult to understand. I mean, unless someone says, no, I've never even felt that with anybody. But I think many people, that's a natural part of, quote, falling in love, that's the euphoria, right? One is open too. But one finds over time, one closes up. One closes up, closes up, closes up, the walls go up, we get brittle. I think it needs to be renewed. I think people need a very clear template. As I said earlier, I used to always say to couples, you know, yeah, falling in love is easy. You know, anybody can do it. You know, you can have you can be an idiot and fall in love. You can be 12 years old and fall in love, right? I mean, you can be 100 years old. Anybody can fall in love. But creating a loving relationship, that's not so easy. And that's, I think, what we're talking about. And I think that's why in our community we practice loving kindness. That's why once a week we do loving kindness and compassion practices. I mean, hopefully people are attending these things and using them in their life. Not just as an abstract kind of thing, but yeah. I mean, we need to learn how to love. To love means to care about. To love means to be kind to. To love means to be open to another human being, open to their causes and conditions, open to their suffering, want to help them, want to support them. Right? I mean... Yeah, I think this is a aspect of Dharma that we're constantly renewing. You know, I would hope more people would take advantage of these practices because you can use them in your relationships, even your closest relationships. That's where we should be using them. I mean, many people think, oh, I practice loving kindness, I practice compassion. I do it for everyone. I practice it for the whole world, right? I send it out everywhere. So what? That's what I say. So what? Well, I want to know, do you send it to the people you live with? Do you send it to people you work with? Do you send it to the people that you have difficulty with? That's what it's about. Yes.
Would you advise someone...
And also anybody in here. Yes?
Would you advise someone to try online dating during a time such as this when it is tough to meet people in real life?
Wow, I feel like I'm moving into slippery territory here. So this is something that I just know. Yeah, I understand that online dating is very common, obviously, in times of COVID even more. I mean, again, it's not the medium that's important. Again, is how do you show up in that online dating situation as yourself? I mean, somebody told me, I remember I read or something, that many people like don't even put picture, they put Photoshop pictures of themselves, or you know, they may be 60 years old, but they put up a picture of themselves at 30 or something. You know what I mean? Or, you know, so I mean, yeah. So I mean, yeah, can I be genuine? You know, I mean, this is not public relations. So I would say, you know, I mean, in a certain sense, online dating is a certain way, I guess, of meeting people and connecting with people. But can one do it in a genuine, open, honest way? This is who I am. And I guess it's what, both sides, it's this is who I am and this is the kind of person I'm looking for. You know, and be, again, I don't, yeah, to me it's, I mean, maybe online dating is even better than the other way where you, you know, meet people at parties or bars or something and God knows what happens next. You know what I'm saying? So maybe this is a better way because there is some screening, I guess. But yeah, I mean, people can be deceptive online, people can be deceptive, you know, meeting them face to face. I mean, when I was a therapist, people, you know, especially when they were problematic or they were, you know, beginning to separate or da-da-da, you know, their response always was, this is not the person I married. Ever hear that? But no, it is the person you married. You know, it's either, you know, you weren't attending to these parts of them or they were on their best behavior, just like you. You know, I mean, that just, that's the way it is. So it's, you know, maybe it's better to be genuine than on your best behavior, within bounds. Yes, Heather. And anybody in here can ask. Yes.
Okay. If one is trying to become less hedonistically oriented, what practices should you try to incorporate more, especially in this time of social isolation and not being able to be directly present with people as often?
Yeah. So again, you know, the Buddha rejected extremes. He rejected asceticism, complete denial of pleasure, and he rejected hedonism, a life based on pleasure seeking. He said there's a middle way, right? That's how we practice. And again, as I said earlier, as human beings, as lay people, we live in the world of pleasant and unpleasant. We live in the world of pleasure and things that aren't pleasure. We live in the world of desire. We live in the world of aversion. I mean, this is our world, right? This is the world that we navigate. And the whole teachings of Buddha is how do you navigate that in a way that does the least harm, and does the most wholesomeness. Is that clear? So, there is pleasure in life. There are many things in life that are pleasurable. Such as what? Such as eating. Right? Enjoying tastes. Such as sensuality, which means senses. There are nice smells. There are nice things to see. There are nice things to taste. There are nice things to feel. I mean, that's, you know, there's lots of ways that, you know, we can get pleasure in life. We can get pleasure when we look at things that give us pleasure, which often can be people. Or, you know, I mean, it can be pleasurable. Reading can be pleasurable. Listening to music can be pleasurable. I mean, there are many, you know, helping people is pleasurable. Having a meaningful conversation with somebody is pleasurable. Playing with children is pleasurable, right? I mean, there's lots of pleasurable things, you know, walking in nature. I mean, there's so many, this world is filled with pleasurable activities, you know, that one doesn't need special pleasurable activities, you see, and that's the problem. We demean our daily life. We demean the sensual experience of our daily life. We demean that, or we don't attend to it. And we're looking for extraordinary pleasures. You know, we're, in a sense, we're like addicts who indulgence in their substance is at a higher order. They can no longer get pleasure out of, you know, the simplest. They need more. And that is a very dangerous spiral, because it isn't, again, it's like a thirsty person drinking more and more salt water and only get thirstier. Yeah, so again, I think one has to, one, be aware and really look at how many things in my life are driven by a seeking for pleasure, a needing pleasure. One thing, where is that coming from? Am I bored? Is boredom a very fundamental quality of my life? Lack of involvement, right? Do I not feel good? Do I have afflictive emotions in me that I don't want to feel, so therefore I go seeking temporary pleasure, right? So I mean, that's what I meant about, we have to look deeply. We can't just come in, oh, hedonism bad, got to go change right away. That's the external way. The internal way is we stop, we pause, we step back, and we look. We look at our pleasure-seeking behaviors, and we see they are quite pervasive in my life. Then I go, well, what's underneath that? I mean, it's a habit. I realize it's a habit, but like, what's underneath it? It's a willingness to use one's mindfulness, one's introspection, one's capacity for self-reflection to understand oneself more deeply. Right? And then the answer is not asceticism, denial, nor is it, you know, continued indulgence. Is, you know, what's there a middle way that I can find to navigate this life in a way that is meaningful and wholesome? But if the forces in my life that are driving me are negative, are afflictive, are coming from fear, boredom, meaninglessness, loneliness, if those are the things that are driving me, you know, those are not going to lead, like produces like. Unwholesome cannot produce wholesome. Unwholesome always produces unwholesome. Only wholesome inspirations, wholesome motivations, wholesome intentions will produce wholesome outcomes. Again, this takes the capacity, and this sort of deals with what we're trying to be dealing this month, and since, you know, do I reflect on my life? Am I reflective? Do I reflect on other people in my life who are acting in certain ways without judging them? Where is this coming from? What's going on with them? Why do they do this? You see, why does that young person need a beer before he can have any or she have any social engagement? It's because they're suffering. We have to name it for what it is, they're suffering. They're suffering from fear. They're suffering from self-doubt. Well, how can I help them in a meaningful way? You see, we need to be this way with ourselves. Yeah, I think it's time to... actually, let me just read somebody else who was talking about teenagers. It seems that marijuana... No, it's, who wrote me? It seems that marijuana use is rampant among... Because I think it, I'd like to end on this. It seems that marijuana use is rampant amongst young people, and I see that even in people my age, especially with legalization in some states. It is scary because without the ability to see things as they really are, and to accept things as they are, as uncomfortable and painful as some things are, it is understandable that the allure of intoxicants can be quite strong. Buddhism is so valuable in teaching us to examine our minds continually and to understand the nature of our suffering. If we really understand our suffering, we will not look to worldly things to assuage that suffering. So this was written by one of you. I will close on that. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And thank you for your questions and your comments. And hopefully this has stirred things up. And let's see where it goes in our community and with you individually.